today. Lay off the lawnmowers, put away the pesticides, plant lots of bulbs. We'll hear about the ways we can prime our parks and gardens for pollinators and one particular project that's creating a bit of a buzz. Éireann Ealaíne has a head-to-head with Minister for Communications, Climate Action and Environment, Richard Bruton, and a glimpse into our greener future. Could e-bikes be the key to bringing down our transport emissions? We take a trip to a specialist bike shop looking at features on budget and high-end models.
Okay, we have a particularly fancy looking bike behind us, and I believe it's the most expensive one in the shop, so maybe you tell us why it's so amazing.
Yeah, so this is a Stromer ST5, and the retail price on that is €9,750, which is a little bit extravagant, some would argue, for a bike. So it's a very premium brand. It's a much larger capacity battery than any of the other ones, so it's a kilowatt-hour battery. So Stromer will quote up to 180 kilometres of range before you need to charge it. It's got a few other cool features as well. So it has regenerative braking, so as you freewheel or as you brake, you're going to put a little bit more power back into your battery. Again, it's got a similar supernova light set, so you've got a brake light and you also have a high and low beam that you can dip depending. This is the one we were chatting about earlier that has a few cool safety features. So you can lock it via pin code, so if anyone moves it you get a push notification to your phone. It has a built-in GPS tracker, which is particularly useful if it does go missing. Well, there's an onboard computer on it that lets you tweak exactly how much torque you have to put into the pedals before it starts to assist you, and as well you can tweak the progression as well. So there's no end of sort of techie cool stuff on this bike, which is kind of the reason for the price point.
Seems like an awful lot of money for a bike, but that's the way it's going.
Raindrops are falling on my head, and just like the guy whose feet are too big for his bed, nothing seems to fit. Those raindrops are falling on my head, they keep falling. So I just did need some talking to the sun.
Anyway, the decline of bee populations globally is a well-publicised issue, not least on this programme, and one that could have a dramatic impact on our food supply. Crops pollinated by bees make up 35% of overall food production, but pollinator numbers are in decline due to a combination of factors including habitat loss, intensification of agriculture, hunger due to a decline in wildflowers, and poisoning by pesticides. One third of Irish bee species are now threatened with extinction. The All-Ireland Pollinator Plan is about creating a landscape where pollinators like bees can survive and thrive. And everyone from farmers to schoolgoers, gardeners, businesses and local authorities have a part to play. Dunleary-Rathdown County Council has recently launched their Do Not Cut or Spray for Nature Wildlife Areas plan. This project aims to manage roadside verges, green spaces and parks in a way that supports and encourages pollinators. By changing how they mow these areas and by reducing pesticides, they're also growing these wildlife corridors across the country and increasing biodiversity. Éireann Ealaíne made a beeline for Marley Park, where she met with Chief of Parks with Dunleary-Rathdown County Council, Rory O'Dooling, to find out more.
There's always roadside signs up for something or another, but when I saw one that said, Limit Tear Fia Gulva, No Bwin, No Spray All, Nature Wildlife Area, Do Not Cut or Spray, stuck in the roadside, I thought to myself, now what is this all about? And I saw that this particular one was owned by Dunleary-Rathdown Council. So I thought, what shall I do? I shall go and ask the Chief of Parks with Dunleary-Rathdown County Council, Rory O'Dooling, what's going on. How are you, Rory?
How are you, Éireann? You're welcome to DLR.
Thank you very much. Now I'm looking at this sign, Nature Wildlife Area, Do Not Cut or Spray. This is just a roadside verge. Is this just you lot being lazy?
I know it could be perceived as that, but the reason the sign is there is to tell people that this is actually an intervention rather than just leaving it go. The council has obligations under the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan, and one of the objectives is obviously to increase the biodiversity corridors along our roads, motorways, also roundabouts and other areas at junctions. So traditionally you would see grass manicured, sprayed, cut within an inch of its life sometimes. So we changed that and we're letting the grass go, but we're also making other interventions in terms of pollinator-friendly bulb planting and other issues like that.
So this is all part of the pollinator plan. I don't think people understand really the importance of pollination. There are only two types of plants in the world. Plants that are pollinated by the wind and plants that are pollinated by insects. I know there's a few water pollinated ones, but in general. So the plants that are pollinated by the wind are mostly grasses, so wheat, barley, grasses of all sorts, and trees. And everything else is pollinated by insects. So if we don't have insects to pollinate them, we'll be reduced to eating bread and no jam. There won't be any fruit or anything like this. So it's hugely important. So it isn't just saving a few bees. It isn't just saving dandelions. It's actually saving creatures that are needed to keep the whole thing going. So I think that's really important, that people would understand that pollinators are actually going to plants looking for nectar in the main, apart from the bees. Nobody actually wants the pollen. It's just a byproduct of sticking your head in. You're going to the flower for, like, going to the pub. You're going for a drink. You're going for nectar. The pubs aren't much good. You only get one drink in every pub. You have to go off to the next one with your head covered in the pollen, and you bring the pollen from one plant to another. It's really simple. But if we don't have the flowers, if we don't have sources of nectar, we're not going to have pollination. And if we've no pollination, we have no seeds, no fruit, no nothing, and plants can't survive. So it's as critical and as fundamental as that.
It is, and it's a very simple solution. It's not taking a huge amount of critical investment on our part. In some cases, in other of our roadside margins, we'd have no bulb planting, for example, and we just let the grass grow early on in the season. We let the dandelions grow, and that's something traditionally we would be cutting the head off them as soon as you see them. And if you interpret a field of yellow, you know, what is the difference between a field of dandelions and a field of daffodils? You know, really, other than the dandelions might be better, in fact, for pollinators than the daffodils would be.
Well, they would be, I suppose, because, like, I suppose dandelions are native plants, aren't they? Daffodils are sort of gardeny ones. But the thing about it is that if you don't have any maintenance and you let the stuff grow, then you're going to have things coming up that can't survive getting their heads cut off. The plants that like their heads cut off are grass, which grow from the bottom, and the rosette plants, like daisies and dandelions, that are growing from the bottom. Yeah. And the more you mow, the more you actually make this place suitable for daisies and dandelions, because they can grow from the bottom. So the ones that grow from the top, all at the moment, as the hedgerows are full of cow parsley, there's full of things like beautiful bits of meadowsweet. These things that, if you cut their heads off, aren't going to come back. So what you're trying to do is not so much encourage the grass, but encourage all the other things that wouldn't survive being cut once.
It's also very important for us to manage the expectation and the message. And we're coming back to your first question about the signage. It's massively important that we let people know what we're doing and why we're doing it. The other measure we would talk about is eliminating herbicide usage, for example.
No
spraying at all. So that, and I'm even finding, and I have a lot of years of experience in this, that for the first time this year, people are demanding that we spray less. You know, and we used to spray around the base of trees, for example. This is my favourite example. So traditionally, the council goes in, we have trees in a grass area, so we spray all around the base, we kill everything off, it's lovely and brown, the roots start to get exposed, the soil starts to disappear, but it's great because the grass machine doesn't hit the tree when it's cutting the grass. So you start to think about that for a while, you say, actually, isn't that madness? We're spraying so a machine doesn't hit the tree when it's cutting the grass. So there's all kinds of things there which we're now looking at. But we have to manage expectations, because people are used to manicured areas, and some. But we have to tell them, you know, if you want to do this, this is the way it's going to look and this is the way it's going to feel.
What do you think of the word weed? People say, well, if you don't do it, the place will be full of weeds. What is a weed, Rory?
I don't know what a weed is anymore. My training...
A weed is a plant in the wrong place.
Yes.
Isn't that what it's supposed to be?
Yeah. But my training was, when I went to college 3,000 years ago, was to how to kill everything. And now that's changed. It's changed. It's how, you know, it's now questioning, what have we lost? What should grow here? What would grow here? And how do we get back to that?
Plants in the right place are wild flowers. So if you have a dandelion or a daisy growing on a roadside verge, that's right. If you decide that you need a manicured lawn and you don't want a daisy in the middle of your lawn, well, that's your problem, because gardening, as we all know, is an unnatural practice. You take out the stuff that naturally grows and put in things that you prefer. Whereas what you're letting happen along the roadside verges is whatever's there will come and be in its natural habitat,
exactly,
which is at the roadside verge, kind of a half woodlandy place, really.
And the other interesting thing about that is that you're creating a corridor. So a corridor for movement of insects. Now, if they move across, they're going to get swatted by something. But at least if you have a long margin, you know, and we try to encourage that there are connections between those so that you end up with some kind of wildlife corridors, even in the busiest of roads and the busiest of cities. And we can all work on that. We can all encourage that. We do that through our hedgerows anyway.
What about the age-old complaints? We have to cut the hedges and we have to cut the verges because the cars can't see round the corner and we'll all have accidents. The roads will be dangerous places. How do you cope with that criticism?
Okay, that's a very good question. I think, obviously, the Wildlife Act has been a wonderful and fantastic help to all of us, and certainly help to wildlife who are still alive because of it. But anyway, the nesting season is fantastic and we stay away from areas during the nesting season unless there is a really definite road danger or some kind of hazard there at a junction, maybe where sight lines are affected or something like that. And in some cases we have to do that.
So it should be an exception rather than a general rule, you know, that you would actually cut roadside verges to make... People should be going slower if they can't see so well. But, I mean, you couldn't tell people to go slower in their cars now, could you?
Yeah, and I know we've had that issue traditionally with roundabouts as well. Our colleagues in on the engineering side of the house would say should have nothing there at all so everybody can see everything. Whereas I've had a lot of roundabouts where you have a good bit of vegetation on it, but if you have a 2 metre mown strip along the outside, then you're fine.
People can see this.
And I agree with you. If there's a barrier there, people do tend to slow down, you know, and it should slow them down. But I just make the point that sometimes we do have to do some work.
The other criticism, let us say, not that I'm making it, but I'm the voice of the people, you understand, in these cases. The criticism is, if you don't mow anything and it's all this long grass and stuff, should the place be overwhelmed with rats and dreadful vermin that we don't want?
Yeah, I've never seen that happen. And I've heard that. I mean, I've even heard criticism that we'd end up people dumping washing machines in the middle of it. And I haven't seen that happen either. A lot of the councils now are adopting wildflower meadows in their parks, for example, in the larger parks, and even in some of the smaller parks. And one of the most beautiful things in high summer is a mown walking strip through the middle of one of those. You see kids running through it and people just getting close to the grass as it grows longer to understand that it's a plant, it's not just a small little
green bit, that there's actually flower heads on it and the wind-blown pollen is coming from those. But, you know, you're talking about leaving this unmown, you're talking about being slow to mow, not to mow your grass too early in the year to let your dandelions come up, and this is policy for the local authorities, but it could be policy for gardeners or people with their own land as well, couldn't it?
Oh, definitely, and I think that's what's so wonderful about the All Ireland Pollinator Plan, because it's not just for local authorities, it's for everybody. And just because the government goes and declares a climate emergency doesn't mean that we can all go home and have a cup of tea and say, that's fine, it's going to be sorted. We all have a role. Every single person has a role. If you have a, you know, 5 square metres of grass in the front, you could think about what you do. Why do you mow that every week? Is there something different you could do with that? If you have a tree in the back, you'd say, think, well, I need to cut that down. Why? Or is it too big for some reason? So everybody has a role.
So you're saying that if you have a front lawn that you've been mowing for years, or you have a piece of a park here that you've been mowing for years, and you stop mowing, that plants will appear that you never saw before, that are dormant in the soil, that are now getting a chance to germinate.
You might even see a cowslip. You never know. You know, what an amazing thing to... And I've seen them, and never mind the neighbours, sure, they might join in, and, you know, you could have a conversation about why you're doing it.
So this notice that we're looking at is actually telling us, you know, nature wildlife area, and it's got a picture of what looks like, for all the world, a dandelion type thing and a bee on it. So all of those yellow flowers that people think are dandelions and weeds are in fact great sources of pollen, because they're collections of little tiny flowers all together. I mean, when you see the dandelion as a clock, every one of those is a little flower that can blow off. So a huge amount of pollen in dandelions,
sure,
particularly. And they're lovely, happy yellow flowers too, aren't they?
They're fabulous. So sometimes it's a matter of perception, you know. It's a perception of what is beauty. If you're looking at a tree, for example, if you look at most of the trees, if you were to go down to Marley Park, for example, and look at the trees, as a group, they look fantastic. If you start to look at individual, they're all a bit wonky. They're kind of, some of them are leaning, falling over, maybe a bit sticking out of them, but that's part of the beauty.
But they're part of a harmony.
Nature.
They're a harmony altogether.
Absolutely.
They're not individual. They're part of a woodland edge.
Absolutely.
So you've just started this, Dunleary Rathdown. Is this your first year of doing this?
This is the first year where we are, yeah, because we have a, I suppose, a landscape management program for all of the county. And we now have 189 locations where we're managing these pollinator non-spraying, non-mow areas. So some of them are tiny, you can imagine the number of them, and some of them are quite big. And we're, our hope and expectation is that is going to increase. And I would strongly urge people to go online and look at the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan, because that lays out all kinds of simple things that anybody and everybody can do. Even your hanging basket, you could do something to encourage pollinators.
So not long before you'll have all these lovely flowers on the verge because you haven't been mowing, and there'll be a whole cloud of butterflies and hoverflies and bees hovering over these, visiting them and doing their pollinating. Because in a way, you know, I think butterflies are like flying flowers, so that's another layer of beauty to look at as well.
And I know that myself, my own back garden, even though I got criticised at home for it, I let the grass grow, and I had a peacock butterfly, and I had never seen one in the back garden before.
This is in the city,
in Dublin 15, sitting on a dandelion in the back garden.
And they're such super butterflies,
beautiful.
Those big ones with peacock, big circles on their wings. You tend to see them, I tend to see them when I'm out on heaths and mountains,
and
away
the
from civilization.
If I cut the grass, that it would never have come there.
Indeed. So well done. So let's all hear it for the nature wildlife area signs. They're great things to see, and we should be looking for more of them. Thanks, Rory, for talking to me.
Thanks very much, Anna.
For more information, you can visit the website rte.ie/Mooney. Well, we've all been hearing the increasingly worrying reports about climate change, an alarm which has been sounding even more loudly over the past few months, with global warming now considered to be the most immediate threat to life on Earth. It's relevant to our lives because it impacts on every single one of us, and every single one of us impacts on it. We're routinely reminded of the urgency with which we need to make personal changes in our daily lives to reduce carbon emissions, whether it's switching off lights, using less hot water, installing a heat pump, or planting a tree. But how we get from A to B is perhaps one of the most significant changes we each can make to combat global warming. And the electric car is currently the most talked about vehicle for that change. But there is another contender. One study found that the overall carbon footprint of e-bikes is nearly identical to traditional bikes. It stated that a cyclist produces 21 grams of CO2 per kilometre travelled, whereas an e-bike user produced just one more gram, about 22 grams of CO2 per kilometre. This is compared with 101 grams by bus and 271 grams by passenger car. But are e-bikes selling in Ireland? What about issues such as how far they can travel on a single charge? Range anxiety, as it's known. Which models are the most popular? And what do you get exactly in an e-bike that's on sale for €10,000? That's right, €10,000. Damien O'Tuama is National Cycling Coordinator for Cyclist.ie, the Irish Cycling Advocacy Network. Green Air is an electric bike specialist shop in Dublin city centre. We sent Damien along with our reporter John Riley into Green Air to find out what's on offer and what it might cost.
Okay, Chris, nice to be in your bike shop. Can you tell us a little bit about it? How long has it been going, and what types of bikes do you sell?
Yeah, absolutely. So Green Air has been going since 2006, 2007. It initially started off actually selling electric cars, funnily enough, and then we transitioned to electric bikes, because I think it just made it was the next logical step, really. I mean, in a city that can't really afford to have any more congestion, any more cars, e-bikes were the smarter solution.
Very good. And is this following a trend at a European level in terms of the growth of e-bikes?
Absolutely. So Ireland does tend to lag behind a little bit in these things in comparison with the rest of mainland Europe, and even the UK is kind of a little bit further on than ourselves. Realistically, I mean, I think one in every four bikes in Germany last year were e-bikes that were sold, and I think they've sold 1 million last year as well. So it's definitely the fastest growing sector of the bike industry. Mm-hmm. Ireland is kind of getting there, but we're a few years off that level of kind of explosion in the market, I think.
So I understand there were 1 million e-bikes sold in Germany in 2018, but in the same year there were only 30,000 e-cars So it really goes to show how much of an advantage that e-bikes provide to the commuting public.
Absolutely, yeah. I think the electric cars are definitely better than just going for, you know, a standard petrol or diesel car from an environmental point of view. But realistically, beyond that, you have all the same issues that you have when you're commuting by car. So you're still sitting in traffic, you're taking up more space, it's, you know, more expensive to park it and all the rest of it. So I think the e-bike gets around a lot of that by... you know, it's cheaper to buy, it's cheaper to run, there's no parking costs, you don't have to wait in the lines of traffic, so you're generally quicker, and then it's more active as well. So even on an individual level, it's healthier, I think.
Can you give us an overview of the types of bikes that customers are buying? What's there, the low end, the middle end, the high end?
Absolutely, yeah. So I suppose starting at the lower end of things, the price point is roughly around 1500. So for something like that, you'd be looking at typically like a folding electric bike with a slightly smaller range, so kind of 40 to 50 kilometres. So they'd be very popular with people who'd say do a part of their commute by train or another mode of public transport and then use that during the day. From then on, you're looking at kind of the majority of sales fall somewhere between maybe 2,000-3,000 euro. That's where people tend to hover at. For that, you're getting a sort of a trekking bike, so kind of similar to a standard hybrid commuting bike, has the lights, the mudguards, the, you know, all the bits and bobs, except it comes without the hard work. So you're looking at sort of 60 to 90 kilometres of range, depending on what model you go with. They kind of just, it feels like you're being pushed up the hills and away from the lights, so it tends to mean you don't have to arrive into work, you know, sweating and all the rest of it. You get there a bit quicker. It's good for leisure as well, given the range.
And did I see a few e-cargo bikes out in the shop out there?
Absolutely, yeah. So the cargo bikes is an interesting one. I think they make a lot of sense for not only kind of families, which is what you typically think of, but businesses as well. So particularly the whole kind of, you know, last mile delivery sort of thing, with the amount of e-commerce that's going on and packages that are delivered. I think the cargo bikes make a lot of sense as essentially the bike's answer to a van. Essentially, you can store a lot of stuff from a business's point of view, and then as well, if you're a family, you can fit 3-4 kids in on a weekly shop as well, happily enough.
E-bikes as a family vehicle, can you elaborate on the types of families coming in? Is it with one child or two children, or how does that all work?
Pretty much every sort of size of family can use an e-bike for car replacement, or a lot of people are doing it as second car replacement as well. For one kid, generally, you wouldn't need more than just a standard electric bike. You wouldn't need to go for a cargo bike. You can get kid seats that will fit onto the back and let you transport a young child around. And you can also load up, you know, a decent weekly shop onto the back of the bike as well. For larger families, then you'd be looking more at cargo models. So you've seen the kind of typical ones that'll have the big sort of bucket in the front, and you can fit sort of 3-4 kids in along with a decent load of cargo as well. You'd have to have a fairly big family before you'd be struggling to find a cargo bike that could suit your needs.
Chris, can you tell us a little bit about the range of the different versions? You know, do you need to worry about recharging them? Is it on a daily basis or on a weekly basis? Or can you give us some insights there?
Yeah, so most of our customers would generally end up charging their e-bike maybe once a week. So for the vast majority of models, you're looking at in and around 60 to 90 kilometres of range. That's without being overly careful about the charge. So unless you have a particularly long commute, you should be fine.
Okay. How long does it take to charge, typically?
So charging times, again, they vary with what battery you have and what charger you have. Anywhere between maybe 3.5 and kind of 5 hours from 0 to 100%.
What's your favourite technological aspect of the bikes that you deal with? What gadget or gizmo excited you the most when you first saw it?
There's always some more innovations. Generally, it's fairly standard. It's lower prices, it's bigger batteries and stronger motors, so that's always coming along. You're starting to see a few different ones. So some of the higher-end e-bikes will come with built-in GPS trackers, and you get push notifications to your phone if someone moves it while you've set it to be in kind of a safe mode. ABS is something that's starting to feature and kind of trickle down from the higher-end e-bikes, so... just again, it's a nice safety feature to have, similar to what you get on a motorbike or a moped. So particularly, I think with cargo bikes, that makes a lot of sense, given, I suppose, the additional weight you'd have on those. And as well, even in just terms of the accessories you can get with the bikes, you can get locks that will have, say, a 100 decibel alarm system built into them. So if someone tries to get through the lock, it's going to go off and keep going until they leave it alone. So there's no end, really, of kind of cool gizmos that they've put onto them.
Maybe we can just go back to the speed of the bikes. Are there a maximum speed speeds or maximum power outputs associated with the different models? If you could explain that a little bit.
So generally, electric bikes are limited to 25 kilometres an hour of assistance. So anything that's limited to that, it's essentially the same as owning a push bike. There's no, you know, requirements to tax or insured or wear a helmet or anything like that. Some models you will be able to order that will be quicker than that, so ones that go up to 45 kilometres an hour. So they're quite common in mainland Europe and Germany and all the rest of it. That's something that you would be meant to go to get taxed and insured, similar to, say, getting a like an AM class moped or something like that, essentially. Yeah, small engine moped.
They're the
yeah.
speed pedelecs.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. From a cycling advocate's perspective, we're very, you know, very supportive of the growth in e-bikes, and it's expanding the types of people who can use them. Older people, maybe people who've had leg injuries, people who are carrying large weights, people who live in hilly areas, maybe, you know, Cork or Kinsale or Drogheda or Enniskerry or other hilly towns. So when you get people coming in, what are their motivations for buying the e-bikes, I suppose?
So it varies, I suppose, from person to person. As you mentioned, a big part of it is, say, people who are getting older or people who've had, you know, injuries or operations that mean that the strain of like climbing a hill on a standard bike isn't particularly pleasant, so they tend to opt for an electric bike. You're seeing a lot of people as well who would typically commute either via car or by some means of public transport that have just kind of figured out that it's generally a lot quicker on a bike because you don't have to wait in the lanes of traffic, and it's a bit more active and a bit more a bit more pleasant and healthy as well to head in when you're moving and you're out in the fresh air, as opposed to standing like a sardine on the Lewis or sitting in your car for an hour just to get into town. So that'd be another big part of it as well, is people who aren't, you know, they're not getting older or they don't have any health issues, they've just figured out that this is a much quicker and cheaper alternative to either public transport or their own cars.
So we currently have the fabulous Bike to Work scheme that was introduced in 2009 to incentivise people buying decent bicycles. So that can obviously be used as well to part fund the purchase of the e-bikes. Is that used in your business?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a huge part of it. As the Cycle to Work scheme is so popular that a very large chunk of our sales would be people putting the £1,000 on the Cycle to Work scheme, and then whatever the excess is has to come out of your own pocket due to that price cap on it. So it's a great initiative, it's a great scheme. We would like to see it expanded. So the UK recently have announced that they're removing that £1,000 cap on it, which is going to enable a lot more people to access electric bikes and use those instead of their cars. So we'd like to see something like that, or even in other countries. I know Belgium are proposing maybe a reduction in the VAT rate on bicycles. So whatever form it would come, I think the Cycle to Work scheme is fantastic, but it is starting to show its age a little bit in terms of the structure. So some e-bike specific scheme or legislation would be fantastic. Yeah,
really, to grow e-bikes and grow cycling, we should look at what cities like Copenhagen have done, or even London, where they have taken out general lanes of traffic and replaced it with high quality safe cycling routes alongside the Thames. It's happening in Brussels, it's happening in Utrecht. So all across Europe there's a shift in mobility from car based solutions to much more efficient solutions around bikes, e-bikes, integration with buses, trams, trains, etc. So there is this mobility shift happening, and I think e-bikes are very much at the heart of that.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think there's plenty of cities you can look to as prime examples. You know, even looking towards the likes of Amsterdam, it used to be a similar situation to Dublin, where it was very, very car-based and sort of car-focused. That changed over the course of a couple of decades to what it is now, which is very much the focus on bikes and e-bikes. And really the reason that happened was there was the political will there, and there was the want for it, and they built the infrastructure. And it's the classic case of if you build it, they'll come. So they have a much healthier, happier, less congested city because of it. So that's what we'd be looking to as a sort of a good model for what Dublin could be.
So here we are on the shop floor. What do we have here, Chris?
We've got a couple of our sort of better selling e-bikes here. So they're really good in terms of price point and in terms of the spec that you get on them as well. So this one here on the left, the kind of more traditional looking e-bike with the battery sitting on it, is a High Bike Trekking 1.0. So it's coming in at 2,200, and it's a really popular option because it kind of comes with everything you need. It has the mudguards, the lights, the kickstand. So really, other than the lock, there's not much else you need. And generally you'd be looking at about 60 kilometres before you'd have to charge it. Again, If you're being careful, you can extend that out quite a bit more, but 60 without being overly careful. And it's plenty of carrying capacity as well. So you could easily load up, you know, yourself, a kid, some shopping on, and kind of use it as not only a commuter, but a bit of a second car replacement as well.
It looks like an everyday bike, really.
Pretty much, yeah. So Highbike is a German brand, and it kind of does show through a little bit in terms of just it just oozes practicality. It kind of, and that's the main concern there, just making a really functional, useful bike to have.
What else would you like to show us? What's the next step in the e-bike customers' option range?
So there's a few you could go for. I might draw your attention to one of these, which is a slightly newer style of electric bike. This one is from Orbea. So this is a much more lightweight system. So that's one concern that some people have, is the weight of electric bikes. And this particular one is a Gain F40, and it weighs about 14 kilograms. So it's not too far off a conventional bike weight. And it looks very much like just a standard bike as well, really, unless you knew what you were looking for. If that went past you, you wouldn't really guess that it has any kind of assistance in it. So a lot of people are kind of moving towards those as something they can use maybe on the weekends as well as a regular push bike, and then just throw the assistance on as and when they need it for the hills, the wind, and that kind of thing.
Can you describe what's in front of us, please, Chris?
Yeah, so in front of us then we have a selection of some of our electric cargo bikes. So these two right in front of us, the black and the white one, are from a company called Urban Arrow. So those are always really popular sellers there. They're good in terms of price. So they'd be starting at about 4,500 thereabouts and kind of working your way up, depending on what kind of spec you wanted to go for, if you wanted to get some more specialist parts for it, essentially.
And you'd put maybe two or three children in these ones here?
Yeah, so out of the box then, there's one bench in it, so you can fit two kids. You can see that there with the seat belts and all the rest. And they have an optional second bench that you can put at the front, so the three or four kids can face each other and have a chat. And then you've plenty of room still in the middle for, you know, your bags of shopping or whatever else is you need to transport.
Chris, to give us a sense of the power, would you get up, for example, St. Patrick's Hill in Cork on one of those?
Yeah, absolutely. So any hill, really, they can handle. It's on these particular ones, you have a Bosch Performance CX motor, which is Bosch's highest-end motor. So you tend to find it in a lot of mountain bikes. So it's really, really rugged, and it's got a 75 newton meter torque rating. So I know that doesn't mean a huge amount to a lot of people, but it's a fantastic torque output. It's plenty of pull. You could almost climb a wall on the thing. You know, it's designed with off-road use in mind. So climbing really short, steep, aggressive climbs or more longer gradual ones, really it's no bother to it.
Chris, before we go, can you show us the creme de la creme of e-bikes in your shop, please? The top of the range, we'd love to see them.
In terms of the higher-end e-bikes, then, we'd be looking primarily at two companies. So there's Ries & Müller and then Stromer. So that's a German and a Swiss brand, respectively. So this is a Ries & Müller homage model. So Ries & Müller is an interesting company. They're all bespoke bikes, so they're all made to order. So essentially, you choose what base model you want, and then you can kind of customize it to your needs, and they build it up for you. So this particular one is an interesting one. It has an ABS system on it, so you can't actually lock up your wheels. So you've plenty of traction and braking modulation, which is pretty interesting. Rather than a chain, it has a carbon belt drive, so similar to like a timing belt in a car. So it's much lower maintenance. You don't need to lubricate it. So it kind of eliminates that thing if you get into work and you've got a lot of oil up the side of your trouser leg. Other than that, then you've gotten a 500 watt hour battery, so you're looking at maybe 80 kilometers of range without being overly careful. It has a Supernova light set, so really bright headlights and a brake light as well, which is something that we're seeing a lot more come in. So it's again very, very safety focused and practical. And a few other neat features as well. So it's got a horn, so you can kind of alert other traffic to your presence. Kind of oversized tires for a bit more comfort. And then it's a dual suspension bike as well. So you have a suspension fork in the front and then a shock hidden away just over where the motor is sitting on the rear as well. So it feels very, very plush and cushiony to ride. If you were to go with build that we have in front of us, you'd be looking about 6,500 thereabouts. So it's a bit higher end. Most people don't tend to go that high, but there is a lot of kind of newer and neater features that you're getting on that.
Okay, we have a particularly fancy looking bike behind us, and I believe it's the most expensive one in the shop. So maybe you can tell us why it's so amazing.
Yeah, so this is a Stromer ST5, and the retail price on that is €9,750, which is a little bit extravagant, some would argue, for a bike. So it's a very premium brand. It's a much larger capacity battery than any of the other ones, so it's a kilowatt-hour battery. So Stromer will quote up to 180 kilometres of range before you need to charge it. It's got a few other cool features as well. So it has regenerative braking. So as you freewheel or as you brake, you're going to put a little bit more power back into your battery. Again, it's got a similar supernova light set. So you've got a brake light and you also have a high and low beam that you can dip depending. It has a few cool safety features. So you can lock it via PIN code. So if anyone moves it, you get a push notification to your phone. It has a built-in GPS tracker, which is particularly useful if it does go missing. Other than that, then, it's pretty cool. There's an onboard computer on it that lets you tweak exactly how much torque you have to put into the pedals before it starts to assist you, and as well, you can tweak the progression as well. So whether you want it to just give you all of the power at once, or whether you want it to kind of a bit more gradually build up to speed. So there's no end of sort of techie cool stuff on this bike, which is kind of the reason for the price point.
The higher-end bikes, who exactly is buying them? Is it a replacement for second cars, or what are the motivations for people buying the particularly expensive ones?
Generally, it's someone who wants to, you know, replace their car and shave a lot of time off their commute. So these ones are ones that will go up to 45 kilometres an hour. And we get a lot of guys who, in particular, maybe are from a motorbiking background, who want something that's a little bit different, a little bit more fun, and then someone who just really wants the best of the best, because realistically you'll be hard pressed to find a higher end e-bike on the market at the moment.
So Chris, thanks for showing us around from a cycling advocate's perspective. We're delighted to see the growth in e-bikes and e-cargo bikes and e-trikes, and it's definitely opening up cycling for a greater range of people, and thank you very much indeed.
No, I'm so glad to have you guys. So yeah, that's our mission. It's smart mobility. It's getting cars off the street, decongesting them, and really every electric bike out there is one less car and one less person crowding on the bus. So that's what we like to see.
Chris Latchford, manager at Green Air in Dublin City Centre, speaking with Damien O'Tooma, National Cycling Coordinator for Cyclist.ie, the Irish Cycling Advocacy Network. Well, as you are hearing there, the future's electric when it comes to getting about, and transportation will have to be a top priority in the coming decades as we confront the climate change crisis. In June of this year, the Irish government published its major blueprint on how Ireland will reach its targets on greenhouse emission reduction set for 2030 and 2050. But how will it actually go about achieving them? Richard Bruton, Minister for Communications, Climate Action and Environment, has responsibility for the plan and how it's going to be delivered. Eni Ní Lonna has been speaking with him.
What do you think of the plan, Minister?
Well, I think it's ambitious, but I think it's realistic. We've gone about this to try and identify things that will be both sensible and fair. So we've identified the sort of changes that can achieve what we need to achieve with the least burden on people and the most opportunity. The reason we're doing it, of course, is that it's vital for the generations and the children to come that we make sure that the planet we pass on is resilient, but more importantly, that Irish farms, Irish enterprises, Irish homes are resilient in the face of major change that is going to occur. You know, the reality is that this is the biggest global challenge that the world faces. We, in the last number of years, have achieved remarkable things in Ireland. You know, we've seen great constitutional change. We've seen an economy come from, you know, near bankruptcy to full employment. But this is the biggest challenge that the globe faces, and we must show that we're able to conquer that as well.
You were a former Minister for Education, so you'll understand when I say, why is this all the I'm sure Oshtonok? Why is it all the future tense? We must do, we will. Why is it taking so long? This is not news. We have known that the planet is warming up for absolutely ages. We had plans for 2020. We were going to have all kinds of electric cars by 2020. 2020 is around the corner, and we have 3,000 electric cars in the country at the moment and hardly a charging point for any of them. So why? And I mean, why is it taking so long? Why are we still talking about the future tense?
Well, I suppose the background to this is the economic crash. When the economic crash came and we saw, you know, hundreds of thousands of people emigrate. We saw 30% of employment fall in some sectors, 300,000 jobs lost. We were back on track. So our climate trajectory seemed like we were going to hit our targets. But however, when we started to see some economic recovery occur, it became clear that we had failed to break the link between restoring economic well-being and carbon emissions. And specifically, the areas where we failed were in transport, in enterprise and in agriculture. All of those areas, as the economy started to recover, as the dairy herd was built, as enterprises grew employment again, we saw once again the growth of emissions. So we have to take a strong stance now. There were targets, as you rightly say, for 2020, but those targets haven't been delivered. They were enshrined in law, so Ireland will pay penalties for failing. But I believe, and the government believes, that we have to get ourselves back on track. We have to correct the flaws in each of the sectors, in the transport sector, in agriculture, in enterprise, and indeed in the built environment, which includes our own homes. And we have to move away from the 85% fossil dependence that we have in this country.
We have 60,000 tonnes of CO2 emissions every single year. So on, we have, you know, whatever, less than 5 million people in the country. But per head, on transport, we put up 2.6 tonnes, whereas the European average is 1.8. On electricity, we actually emit 2.6 tonnes per head, whereas the European average is 2.3. On agriculture, we emit 4 tonnes per head. The European average is 0.8. Now, they had crashes too. They had to recover their economies. Why are we so, so much higher than everybody else? You know, if they can get their emissions down, why can't we?
Well, in each case, it's different. In the electricity area, we have moved quite significantly. We're now 30% renewables. But in many countries, you have a nuclear industry or you have hydro industries, and that has allowed some countries to have much better performance. But the good news is we are committing now to move to 70% renewables on the Irish grid, and that will be very demanding, because we will need to see more wind farms, more infrastructure to support renewable energy. We'll want to extend micro generation for individuals to get involved. We want to see community generation involved in creating renewables. So that's in the electricity area.
Can we stay with electricity now for a minute,
certainly,
before moving on? So I can tell you something to do immediately that will sort out 49% of emissions from electricity, and that is to close down Money Point this minute and close down the two peak burning stations. 49% of our emissions from electricity generation comes from burning coal and turf. And it's crackers. We're burning those turf stations, and they could be closed down in the morning. People work there. I'd realise that. They would have to be re-employed. They would have to be looked after. I'm not saying don't do that. But once the turf is gone, it's gone. It's a carbon source. It's a carbon sink. It's totally inefficient way of making electricity. It's causing pollution in the air. You, as the minister, with a stroke of a pen, could close those down tomorrow. Why don't you?
Well, we have committed to close them down in a phased basis.
In 2027, more Amshar Oshinok. Why not now?
Because every day we need power, and whether it's power to drive our businesses, our farms, our homes, we need that power.
Money Point was closed down for 3 months.
You've all the answers yourself, so work away.
Yeah. Money Point was closed down for a couple of months in the winter, and the grid didn't go down. I'm just saying.
Yeah, but you have to, when the wind doesn't blow, as in, say, a cold winter's day, the wind doesn't blow and you have everyone want to turn on their heat, what do you do then?
Well, you have backups with gas, yes, which is a less significant one. Not coal and peat, I'm saying.
So where do you get those gas stations?
Well, we have gas stations already. Our Dublin one is gas.
So, in other words, if you're going to take out some major part of your generation, like Money Point, you have to make sure that you're still in a position to deliver power to the people who need it. So you have to build up your alternatives. We have to build up our renewable capacity to make sure that we have alternatives. So that's why we'll need more wind farms coming on to meet the rising demand. We will take coal and peat out of the system, and we'll have to replace them with other fallbacks, and they will include new gas stations which can come in at very short notice. We will also have to start looking in the longer term at new storage, a bit like Thurlock Hill, new options. But those are all big changes that we have to take time to invest. You can't, you know, turn a switch. The same as in transport. You can't say, you know, we're now 97% dependent on fossil fuels. Why isn't everyone driving electric cars? You have to do this over stages, because an electric car is more expensive. You have to make sure that people can afford it. So you have to do a plan. And that's really what this is. This is a 10-year plan. There aren't silver bullets in this sphere. You know, there aren't easy, painless solutions like you're suggesting. You know, switch off money point and the job is up. So you just have to plan to make sure that, you know, the lights will still be on, people will still be able to go about their daily lives. And that's really important. You know, energy security to sustain the standard of living that we enjoy is really important.
Now, we've been talking about emissions, putting things up into the environment, up into the atmosphere. The way of getting carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere is by photosynthesis, and the best things at doing them are trees. So we have 11% of the country covered in trees, one of the lowest rates in Europe, and yet a 40-year-old fully grown tree can contain 5 tonnes of CO2. You have said in your in this, or at least it is said in this plan that we were talking about, that 8,000 hectares of forestry is going to be planted every year in order to increase this amount, because it will be a carbon sink. Now, we did 3,000 hectares last year. How are we going to lash it up to 8,000 hectares in a country where people don't like trees, frankly?
Well, again, that will have to be developed. It's much like our renewable. You will have to plan the way that's being delivered. As you know, at the moment, there's a very substantial subsidy. Indeed, the entire cost of planting is supported. And someone who devotes a hectare gets 15 years of payment. And then the timber at the end of that is tax-free. But as you say, there's still there's question marks about that. I think you will have heard the European Commissioner talk about the need for every farmer to be considering having some part of their farm devoted to forestry. So, you know, that is one area that I'm sure will be explored. I think the Minister responsible for forestry will be looking to both public and private sector to see how this can be developed. I think we need to encourage diversification in our farming, as you recognise that at the moment farming is contributing a lot to the emission output. It has the potential to change the way it works to start to reduce that. And you'll see not just the forestry objective, but changing the way fertilisers are used, changing the way manures are spread, changing the management of herd. These are also very much at the heart of the plan. So agriculture can contribute to reducing it. And Chagas has very usefully done work on showing the interventions that farmers can make that are actually, many of them are beneficial to the farm. They, even if there was no carbon challenge, they would be the right things to do. They are cost-effective things to do. And I think it's really important that we move on all fronts to see that agriculture makes its contribution. And I'm delighted to say that they are shaping up to make those contributions.
So, mind you, the trees incentives have been in for a long time, so there's definitely needing to be a public awareness change in that. Hence our wildlife programme, and hence the whole idea of getting people to realise that, you know, growing trees is not something awful to do with your land, but something positive. Because in actual fact, I mean, I didn't come to agriculture because we were talking about the other matters, but actually 1/3 of our emissions come from agriculture. So therefore, if some of the areas where cattle are reared with absolute subsidies for everything, surely if the same subsidies were maybe given to the farmers, because you don't make money on beef only from the subsidies. That's really what makes them, in some marginal areas, better able to do it at all. So, I mean, if they were able to have maybe put some solar panels on their land, grow biofuels, grow trees, and get the same sort of subsidies, why wouldn't they do it?
Yeah, there does need to be a move to new incentives. And I think the new Common Agricultural Policy will be very much looking at that. 40% of the money coming from the new Common Agricultural Policy is going to have to be paid in connection with either reduction of carbon emissions, or greenhouse gas emissions rather, or other environmental gains. So the new Common Agricultural Policy will be built around that. And as you rightly say, even though there's very substantial subsidies towards forestry at the moment, there is a resistance to it, and you see that too much of it is concentrated in individual regions. We need to see it more spread. And I think that will be a challenge for the Department of Agriculture and Forestry in meeting their target, in looking at how do you get that spread. But I think the Common Agricultural Policy and new incentives, as you say, are a way of developing those alternatives.
Yeah, just to finish now, carbon credits, we have to pay carbon, we buy carbon credits because we don't always meet our targets, and this is just spending money on that. I mean, surely spending, what did we spent already, something like 86 million euros on carbon credits just so that we won't be fined. I mean, if that money is available for that, surely it's available for doing something more positive than paying to buy our way out of sin.
Well, these are penalties.
Yeah.
These are failures. They aren't cash in hand. These are penalties for the fact that over the last number of years we haven't got our house in order. We now have to, in order to avoid penalties in the future, make the changes in the way we run our homes and our farms and our enterprises and our power system, so that we will meet those targets. So Europe isn't giving us a big pot of money, or there's no one with a pot of money offering us to say, you know, make these changes. What we have to do, all of us, is to look at our own lives and see how the changes can be made. It has to be said, taxpayers won't be in a position to pay for everything. So while we will support people who are most exposed or least equipped to meet the challenges of change, we can't pay for all the change. So people will have to say, well, next time I'm not going to buy a diesel car, I'm going to switch to electric. Or people will have to say, you know, in the interests of you know, the future of my home, I'm maybe going to look less at that new kitchen and more at the fabric of the house to make sure that, you know, this house is resilient for the future and the changes that are coming our way. So it does require us to think differently about some of the priorities we set in our lives, the ways we spend our money, the way we manage materials, whether, you know, be recycling and preventing waste in the first place. You know, all of these are part of the changes we have to try to internalise. But, you know, government, while we can create a framework and take the lead in key areas like renewable power, we require all the communities, all individuals to come with us to make the changes that will make the difference in the long term.
We've only 11 years left, so you're optimistic we'll have it turned around well before 2030.
Well, I think 2030 is only the start. I think, as you know, Europe, and we support it, is committing to net zero by 2050. So achieving the reductions by 2030 are the start of a longer journey. But it's really important that we start that momentum. And I have selected the things that are sensible, in that they're at the lowest cost to people and that open up the most opportunity. And I think it's important to see this also as opportunity. You know, there will be opportunity in a new renewable sector, in a new retrofitting of homes, in a different way, a different lifestyle. They're going to open up all sorts of new opportunities, be it in forestry or environment management or managing our peatlands. You know, there are new opportunities that are going to emerge from this, and it isn't to be seen as some big burden that's being imposed upon us. This is actually will make our air cleaner, you know, our homes warmer, our enterprises more sustainable for the long term. And I think that's the way we should look at this. We're making changes now and starting now, because if we delay them, they will be at far greater burden and less opportunity for Irish people.
Thank you very much, Minister.
Thank you.
Richard Bruton, Minister for Communications, Climate Action and Environment, speaking with Aina Nilana. That's all we have time for this week. On sound, we had Sheila Nivuil. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. Our researcher is John Riley. And the producer is Sheila O'Callaghan. Don't forget, you can visit the website anytime you like. It's rte.ie/Mooney.